Giles stood up and strolled across the room to Deacon's side. "What aren't you telling me?" he demanded, grabbing him by the ear. Deacon's dropped his pen, nervously touched the bridge of his glasses, and pushed them further up his nose before he eventually squeaked, "He's in some sort of trouble." "What sort of trouble?" asked Giles, twisting the ear. "I think he might even be expelled," whimpered Deacon's. Giles let go of his ear and burst out laughing. "Harry expelled?" he scoffed. "The Pope's more likely to be defrocked." He would have returned to his desk if he hadn't noticed beads of sweat appearing on Deacon's forehead. "What for?" he asked more quietly. "The Frobe thinks he's been stealing from the tuck shop," said Deacon's. If Deacon's had looked up, he would have seen that Giles had turned ashen white. A moment later, he heard the door close. He picked up his pen and tried to concentrate, but for the first time in his life, he didn't finish his prep. When Harry came out of choir practice an hour later, he spotted Fisher leaning on the wall, unable to mask a smile. That was when he realized who must have reported him. He ignored Fisher and strolled back to his house as if he didn't have a care in the world, whereas, in fact, he felt like a man mounting the gallows, knowing that unless he ditched his closest friend, a stay of execution would not be possible. He hesitated before knocking on his housemaster's door. The calm was far gentler than it had been earlier that afternoon. But when Harry entered the room, he was greeted with the same uncompromising stare. He bowed his head. "I owe you a sincere apology, Clifton," said Frobisher, rising from behind his desk. "I now realize that you were not the culprit." Harry's heart was still beating fast, but his anxiety was now for Giles. "Thank you, sir," he said, his head still bowed. He had so many questions he would have liked to ask the Frobe, but he knew none of them would be answered. Mr. Frobisher stepped out from behind his desk and shook hands with Harry, something he'd never done before. "You better hurry, Clifton, if you hope to get any supper." When Harry came out of the Frobe's study, he walked slowly towards the dining room. Fisher was standing by the door, a surprised look on his face. Harry walked straight past him and took his place on the end of the bench, next to Deacon's. The seat opposite him was empty. Chapter 8. Giles didn't show up for supper, and his bed wasn't slept in that night. If St. Bede's hadn't lost their annual fixture against Avonhurst by 31 runs, Harry suspected that not many boys or even masters would have noticed he was missing. But unfortunately for Giles, it was a home match, so everyone had an opinion on why the school's opening batsman had not taken his guard at the crease, not least Fisher, who was telling anyone who cared to listen that the wrong man had been rusticated. Harry hadn't been looking forward to the holidays, not just because he wondered if he'd ever see Giles again, but also because it meant returning to number 27 Stillhouse Lane and once again having to share a room with his Uncle Stan, who more often than not returned home drunk. After spending the evening going over old exam papers, Harry would climb into bed around 10. He quickly fell asleep, only to be woken sometime after midnight by his uncle, who was often so drunk he couldn't find his own bed. The sound of Stan trying to pee into a chamber pot, and not always hitting the target, was something that would remain etched in Harry's mind for the rest of his life. Once Stan had collapsed onto his bed, he rarely bothered to get undressed, Harry would try to fall asleep a second time, often to be woken a few minutes later by loud, drunken snores. He longed to be back at St. Bede's, sharing a dormitory with 29 other boys. Harry still hoped that in an unguarded moment Stan might let slip some more details about his father's death, but most of the time he was too incoherent to answer even the simplest question. On one of the rare occasions when he was sober enough to speak, he told Harry to bugger off, and warned him that if he raised the subject again he'd thrash him. The only good thing about sharing a room with Stan was that there was never any chance of his being late for his paper round. Harry's days at Stillhouse Lane fell into a well-ordered routine. Up at 5, one slice of toast for breakfast, he no longer licked his uncle's bowl, report to Mr. Deakins at the newsagents by 6, stack the papers in the correct order, then deliver them. The whole exercise took about 2 hours, allowing him to be back home in time for a cup of tea with Mum before she went off to work. At around 8:30, Harry would set off for the library, where he would meet up with Deakins, who was always sitting on the top step, waiting for someone to open the doors. In the afternoon, Harry would report for choir practice at St. Mary Redcliffe as part of his obligation to St. Bede's. He never considered it an obligation because he enjoyed singing so much. In fact, he'd more than once whispered, "Please God, when my voice breaks, let me be a tenor, and I'll never ask for anything else." After he returned home for tea in the evening, Harry would work at the kitchen table for a couple of hours before going to bed, dreading his uncle's return every bit as much as he had Fisher's in his first week at St. Bede's. At least Fisher had departed for Colston's Grammar School, so Harry assumed their paths would never cross again. Harry was looking forward to his final year at St. Bede's, although he wasn't in any doubt just how much his life would change if he and his two friends ended up going their separate ways. Giles to he knew not where, Deakins to Bristol Grammar, while if he failed to win a scholarship to BGS, he might well have to return to Merriwood Elementary, and then, at the age of 14, leave school and look for a job. He tried not to think about the consequences of failure, despite Stan never missing an opportunity to remind him he could always find work at the docks. "Boy should never have been allowed to go to that stuck-up school in the first place," he regularly told Maisie once she'd placed his bowl of porridge in front of him. "It's given him ideas above his station," he added, as if Harry wasn't there, a view that Harry felt Fisher would have happily agreed with. But then he'd long ago come to the conclusion that Uncle Stan and Fisher had a lot in common. "But surely Harry should be given the chance to better himself," countered Maisie.
"Why," said Stan, "the docks was good enough for me and his old man. Weren't they good enough for him?" he demanded, with a finality that brooked no argument.
"Perhaps the boy's cleverer than both of us," suggested Maisie. This silenced Stan for a moment, but after another spoonful of porridge he declared,
"Depends on what you mean by clever. After all, there's clever, and then there's clever."
He took another spoonful, but added nothing more to this profound observation. Harry would cut his slice of toast into 4 pieces as he listened to his uncle play the same record again and again every morning. He never spoke up for himself, as clearly Stan had already made up his mind on the subject of Harry's future, and nothing was going to budge him. What Stan didn't realize was that his constant jibes only inspired Harry to work even harder.
"Can't hang around here all day," would be Stan's final comment, especially if he felt he was losing the argument. "Some of us have a job to do," he added, as he rose from the table.
No one bothered to argue.
"And another thing," he said, as he opened the kitchen door. "None of you've noticed the boy's gone soft. He doesn't even lick my porridge bowl no longer. God knows what they've been teaching him at that school."
The door slammed behind him.
"Take no notice of your uncle," said Harry's mother. "He's just jealous. He doesn't like the fact that we're all so proud of you. And he'll even have to change his tune when you win that scholarship, just like your friend Deakins."
"But that's the problem, Mum," said Harry. "I'm not like Deakins, and I'm beginning to wonder if it's all worth it."
The rest of the family stared at Harry in silent disbelief,
until Grandpa piped up for the first time in days.
"I wish I'd been given the chance to go to Bristol Grammar School."
"Why's that, Grandpa?" shouted Harry.
"Because if I had, we wouldn't have had to live with your Uncle Stan all these years."
Harry enjoyed his morning paper round, and not just because it got him out of the house. As the weeks went by, he came to know several of Mr. Deakin's regulars, some of whom had heard him sing at St. Mary's, and would wave when he delivered their paper, while others offered him a cup of tea, even an apple. Mr. Deakins had warned him that there were two dogs he should avoid on the round. Within a fortnight, both of them were wagging their tails when he got off his bicycle. Harry was delighted to discover that Mr. Holcombe was one of Mr. Deakin's regular customers, and they often had a word when he dropped off his copy of the Times each morning. His first teacher left Harry in no doubt that he didn't want to see him back at Merriwood, and added that if he needed any extra tuition, he was free most evenings. When Harry returned to the newsagent's after his round, Mr. Deakins would always slip a penny bar of Fry's chocolate into his satchel before sending him on his way. It reminded him of Giles. He often wondered what had become of his friend. Neither he nor Deakins had heard from Giles since the day Mr. Frobisher had asked to see Harry after prep. Then, before he left the shop to go home, he always paused in front of the display cabinet to admire a watch he knew he'd never be able to afford. He didn't even bother to ask Mr. Deakins how much it cost. There were only two regular breaks in Harry's weekly routine. He would always try to spend Saturday morning with old Jack, taking with him copies of all the previous week's Times, and on Sunday evenings, once he'd fulfilled his duties at St. Mary's, he would rush across the city so he could be at Holy Nativity in time for Evensong. A frail Miss Monday would beam with pride during the treble solo. She only hoped she would live long enough to see Harry go up to Cambridge. She had plans to tell him about the choir at King's College, but not until he'd won a place at Bristol Grammar. "Is Mr. Frobisher going to make you a prefect?" asked old Jack, even before Harry had sunk into his usual seat on the opposite side of the carriage. "I've no idea," replied Harry. "Mind you, the Frobe always says," he added, tugging his lapels, "Clifton, in life you get what you deserve, no more and certainly no less." Old Jack chuckled and just stopped himself saying, "Not a bad imitation of the Frobe." He satisfied himself with, "Then my bet is you're about to become a prefect." "I'd rather win a scholarship to BGS," said Harry, suddenly sounding older than his years. "What about your friends, Barrington and Deakins?" old Jack asked, trying to lighten the mood. "Are they also destined for higher things?" "They'll never make Deakins a prefect," said Harry. "He can't even take care of himself, let alone anyone else. In any case, he's hoping to be the library monitor, and as no one else wants the job, Mr. Frobisher shouldn't lose too much sleep over that appointment." "And Barrington?" "I'm not sure he'll be coming back next term," said Harry wistfully. "Even if he does, I'm fairly certain they won't make him a prefect." "Don't underestimate his father," said old Jack. "That man will undoubtedly have found a way to ensure that his son returns on the first day of term, and I wouldn't put money on his not being a prefect." "Let's hope you're right," said Harry. "And if I am, I presume he will then follow his father to Eton." "Not if he has any say in it. Giles would prefer to go to BGS with Deakins and me." "If he doesn't get into Eton, they're unlikely to offer him a place at the grammar school. Their entrance exam is one of the hardest in the country. He told me he's got a plan. It had better be a good one if he hopes to fool his father as well as the examiners." Harry didn't comment. "How's your mother?" asked old Jack, changing the subject, as it was clear that the boy didn't want to go any further down that path. "She's just been promoted. She's now in charge of all the waitresses in the Palm Court room, and reports directly to Mr. Frampton, the hotel manager.
You must be very proud of her, said old Jack.
Yes, I am, sir. And what's more, I'm going to prove it.
What do you have in mind?
Harry let him into his secret. The old man listened attentively and nodded his approval from time to time. He could see one small problem, but it wasn't insurmountable.
When Harry returned to the shop, having completed his last paper round before going back to school, Mr. Deakins gave him a shilling bonus.
"You're the best paper boy I've ever had," he said.
"Thank you, sir," said Harry, pocketing the money.
"Mr. Deakins, can I ask you a question?"
"Yes, of course, Harry."
Harry walked over to the cabinet, where two watches were displayed side by side on the top shelf.
"How much is that one?"
he asked, pointing to the Ingersoll. Mr. Deakins smiled. He'd been waiting for Harry to ask that question for some weeks, and had his answer well prepared.
6 shillings, he said.
Harry couldn't believe it.
He'd been sure that such a magnificent object would cost more than double that.
But despite his having put aside half his earnings each week, even with Mr. Deakin's bonus, he was still a shilling short.
You do realize, Harry, that it's a lady's watch, said Mr. Deakins.
Yes, I do, sir, said Harry. I was hoping to give it to my mother.
Then you can have it for 5 shillings.
Harry couldn't believe his luck.
Thank you, sir, he said, as he handed over
4 shillings, 1 sixpence, 1 threepence, and 3 pennies, leaving him with empty pockets. Mr. Deakins took the watch out of the display cabinet, discreetly removed the 16-shilling price tag, and then placed it in a smart box. Harry left the shop whistling. Mr. Deakins smiled and placed the 10-shilling note in the till, delighted that he'd fulfilled his part of the bargain.
Chapter 9. The bell went.
"Time to get undressed," said the duty prefect in the new boys' dorm on the first evening of term.
They all looked so small and helpless, Harry thought. One or two of them were clearly fighting back tears, while others were looking around, uncertain what they should do next. One boy was facing the wall, shaking. Harry walked quickly across to him.
"What's your name?" Harry asked gently.
"Stevenson."
"Well, I'm Clifton. Welcome to St. Bede's."
"And I'm Tewkesbury," said a boy standing on the other side of Stevenson's bed.
"Welcome to St. Bede's, Tewkesbury."
"Thank you, Clifton. Actually, my father and grandfather were here before they went on to Eton."
"I don't doubt it," said Harry.
"I'll bet they captained Eton against Harrow at Lord's," he added, immediately regretting his words. "No, my father was a wet bob," said Tewkesbury, unperturbed. "Not a dry bob."
"A wet bob?" said Harry.
"He captained Oxford against Cambridge in the boat race."
Stevenson burst into tears.
"What's the matter?" asked Harry, sitting down on the bed beside him.
"My dad's a tram driver."
Everyone else stopped unpacking and stared at Stevenson.
"Is that right?" said Harry.
"Then I'd better let you into a secret," he added, loud enough to be sure that every boy in the dormitory could hear his words. "I'm the son of a dock worker. I wouldn't be surprised to discover that you're the new choral scholar."
"No," said Stevenson. "I'm an open scholar."
"Many congratulations," said Harry, shaking him by the hand. "You follow in a long and noble tradition."
"Thank you, but I have a problem," the boy whispered.
"And what's that, Stevenson?"
"I don't have any toothpaste."
"Don't worry about that, old chap," said Tewkesbury. "My mother always packs a spare one."
Harry smiled as the bell rang again.
"Everyone into bed," he said firmly, as he walked across the dormitory towards the door.
He heard a voice whisper,
"Thank you for the toothpaste."
"Think nothing of it, old chap."
"Now," said Harry, as he flicked off the light, I don't want to hear another word from any of you until the bell goes at 6:30 tomorrow morning."
He waited for a few moments before he heard someone whispering, "I meant it. Not another word."
He smiled as he walked down the staircase to join Deakins and Barrington in the senior prefect's study. Harry had been surprised by two things when he arrived back at St. Bede's on the first day of term. No sooner had he walked through the front door than Mr. Frobisher took him to one side.
"Congratulations, Clifton," he said softly.
"It won't be announced until assembly tomorrow morning, but you're to be the new school captain."
"We should have been Giles," said Harry without thinking.
"Barrington will be captain of games, and—"
Harry had leapt in the air the moment he heard the news that his friend would be returning to St. Bede's. Old Jack had been right when he said Mr. Hugo would find a way to make sure his son was back for the first day of term. When Giles walked into the front hall a few moments later, the two boys shook hands, and Harry never once referred to the subject that must have been on both their minds.
"What are the new bugs like?" Giles asked, as Harry entered the study.
"One of them reminds me of you," said Harry.
"Tewkesbury, no doubt."
"You know him?"
"No, but Papa was at Eton at the same time as his father."
"I told him I was the son of a docker," said Harry, as he slumped into the only comfortable chair in the room.
"Did you now?" said Giles.
"And did he tell you he's the son of a cabinet minister?"
Harry said nothing.
"Are there any others I should keep an eye out for?" asked Giles.
"Stevenson," said Harry. "He's a cross between Deakins and me."
"Then we better lock the fire escape door before he makes a dash for it."
Harry often thought about where he might be now if old Jack hadn't talked him into returning to St. Bede's that night.
"What's our first lesson tomorrow?" asked Harry, checking his timetable.
"Latin," said Deakins, "which is why I'm guiding Giles through the First Punic War."
264 to 241 BC, said Giles.
"I bet you're enjoying that," said Harry.
"Yes, I am," said Giles, "and I just can't wait for the sequel, the Second Punic War."
218 to 201 BC, said Harry.
"It always amazes me how the Greeks and Romans seem to know exactly when Christ would be born," said Giles.
"Ho, ho, ho," said Harry.
Deakins didn't laugh, but said, "And finally, we will have to consider the Third Punic War, 149 to 146 BC.
"Do we really need to know about all three of them?" said Giles.
St. Mary Redcliffe was packed with town and gown who'd come to celebrate an Advent service of 8 readings and 8 carols. The choir made their entrance through the nave and advanced slowly down the aisle, singing, "O Come All Ye Faithful," then took their places in the choir stalls. The headmaster read the first lesson. This was followed by "O Little Town of Bethlehem." The service sheet indicated that the soloist for the third verse would be Master Harry Clifton. How silently the wondrous gift is given, while God... Harry's mother sat proudly in the third row, while the old lady sitting next to her wanted to tell everyone in the congregation that they were listening to her grandson. The man seated on the other side of Maisie couldn't hear a word, but you would never have known that from the contented smile on his face. Uncle Stan was nowhere to be seen. The captain of games read the second lesson, and when Giles returned to his place, Harry noticed that he was seated next to a distinguished-looking man with a head of silver hair, who he assumed must be Sir Walter Barrington. Giles had once told him that his grandfather lived in an even larger house than his, but Harry didn't think that could be possible. On the other side of Giles sat his mother and father. Mrs. Barrington smiled across at him, but Mr. Barrington didn't once look in his direction. When the organ struck up the prelude for We Three Kings, the congregation rose and sang lustily. The next lesson was read by Mr. Frobisher, after which came what Miss Munday anticipated would be the highlight of the service. The thousand-strong congregation didn't stir, while Harry sang Silent Night, with a clarity and confidence that caused even the headmaster to smile. The library monitor read the next lesson. Harry had already coached him through some Mark's words several times. Deakins had tried to get out of the chore, as he described it to Giles, but Mr. Frobisher had insisted. The fourth lesson was always read by the librarian. Deakins wasn't Giles, but he wasn't bad. Harry winked at him as he shuffled back to his seat next to his parents. The choir then rose to sing In Dulce You Below, while the congregation remained seated. Harry considered the carol to be among the most demanding in their repertoire because of its unconventional harmonies. Mr. Holcombe closed his eyes so that he could hear the senior choral scholar more clearly. Harry was singing, Now Let All Hearts Be Singing, when he thought he heard a slight, almost imperceptible crack in the voice. He assumed Harry must have a cold. Miss Munday knew better. She'd heard those early signs so many times before. She prayed that she was mistaken, but knew her prayer would not be answered. Harry would get through the rest of the service with only a handful of people realizing what had happened, and he would even be able to carry on for a few more weeks, possibly months. But by Easter, another child would be singing, Rejoice that the Lord has arisen. An old man, who'd turned up only moments after the service had begun, was among those who weren't in any doubt what had happened. Old Jack left just before the bishop gave his final blessing. He knew Harry wouldn't be able to visit him until the following Saturday, which would give him enough time to work out how to answer the inevitable question.
"Might I have a private word with you, Clifton?" said Mr. Frobisher, as the bell sounded for the end of prep. "Perhaps you'd join me in my study."
Harry would never forget the last time he'd heard those words. When Harry closed the study door, his housemaster beckoned him towards a seat by the fire, something he had never done before. "I just wanted to assure you, Harry," another first, "that the fact you are no longer able to sing in the choir will not affect your bursary. We at St. Bede's are well aware that the contribution you have made to school life stretches far beyond the chapel."
"Thank you, sir," said Harry. "However, we must now consider your future. The music master tells me that it will be some time before your voice fully recovers, which I'm afraid means that we must be realistic about your chances of being offered a choral scholarship to Bristol Grammar School."
"There is no chance," said Harry calmly.
"I have to agree with you," said Frobisher. "I am relieved to find you understand the situation. But," he continued, "I would be happy to enter your name for an open scholarship to BGS. However," he added before Harry had time to respond, "in the circumstances, you might consider that you'd have a better chance of being offered a bursary at, say, Colston's School or King's College, Gloucester, both of which have far less demanding entrance examinations."
"No, thank you, sir," said Harry. "My first choice remains Bristol Grammar." He'd said the same thing to old Jack just as firmly the previous Saturday, when his mentor had mumbled something about not burning your boats.
"So be it," said Mr. Frobisher, who had not expected any other response, but had still felt it was nothing less than his duty to come up with an alternative. "Now, let's turn this setback to our advantage."
"How do you suggest I do that, sir?"
"Well, now that you've been released from daily choir practice, you will have more time to prepare for your entrance exam."
"Yes, sir, but I still have my responsibilities, and I will do everything in my power to ensure that your duties as school captain are less onerous in future."
"Thank you, sir."
"By the way, Harry," said Frobisher as he rose from his chair, "I've just read your essay on Jane Austen, and I was fascinated by your suggestion that if Miss Austen had been able to go to university, she might never have written a novel, and even if she had, her work probably wouldn't have been so insightful."
"Sometimes it's an advantage to be disadvantaged," said Harry.
"That doesn't sound like Jane Austen," said Mr. Frobisher.
"It isn't," replied Harry.
"But it was said by someone else who didn't go to university," he added, without explanation. Maisie glanced at her new watch and smiled.
"I'll have to leave now, Harry, if I'm not going to be late for work."
"Of course, Mum," said Harry, leaping up from the table. "I'll walk with you to the tram stop."
"Harry, have you thought about what you'll do if you don't win that scholarship?" said his mother, finally asking a question she'd been avoiding for weeks.
"Constantly," said Harry, as he opened the door for her. "But I won't be given much choice in the matter. I'll just have to go back to Merriwood, and when I turn 14, I'll leave and look for a job."
Chapter 10. "Do you feel ready to face the examiners, my boy?" asked old Jack.
"As ready as I'm ever likely to be," replied Harry.
"By the way, I took your advice and checked over the examination papers for the past 10 years.
You were right. There's a definite pattern, with some of the same questions coming up at regular intervals."
"Good. And how's your Latin coming on? We can't afford to fail that, however well we do in your other papers."
Harry smiled when old Jack said "we."
"Thanks to Deakins, I managed 69% in mocks last week, even if I did have Hannibal crossing the Andes."
"Only about 6,000 miles out," chuckled old Jack.
"So what do you think will be your biggest problem?"
"The 40 boys from St. Bede's who are also taking the exam, not to mention the 250 from other schools."
"Forget them," said old Jack. "If you do what you're capable of, they won't be a problem."
Harry remained silent.
"So how's your voice coming along?" asked old Jack, who always changed the subject whenever Harry fell silent.
"Nothing new to report," said Harry. "It could be weeks before I know if I'm a tenor, a baritone, or a bass, and even then there's no guarantee I'll be any good. One thing's for certain. BGS aren't going to offer me a choral scholarship while I'm like a horse with a broken leg."
"Snap out of it," said old Jack. "It's not that bad."
"It's worse," said Harry. "If I was a horse, they'd shoot me and put me out of my misery."
Old Jack laughed.
"So when are the exams?" he asked, even though he knew the answer.
"Thursday week. We start with general knowledge at 9 o'clock, and there are 5 other papers during the day, ending with English at 4.
"It's good that you finish with your favourite subject," said Jack.
"Let's hope so," said Harry.
"But pray there's a question on Dickens, because there hasn't been one for the past 3 years, which is why I've been reading his books after Lights Out."
"Wellington wrote in his memoirs," said old Jack, "that the worst moment of any campaign is waiting for the sun to rise on the morning of battle."
"I agree with the Iron Duke, which means I won't be getting much sleep for the next couple of weeks."
"All the more reason not to come and see me next Saturday, Harry. You ought to be making better use of your time. In any case, if I remember correctly, it's your birthday."
"How did you know that?"
"I confess that I didn't read it on the court page of the Times, but as it fell on the same day last year, I took a gamble and bought a small gift for you."
He picked up a parcel wrapped in a page from one of last week's newspapers and handed it to Harry.
"Thank you, sir," said Harry as he untied the string.
He removed the newspaper, opened the small dark blue box, and stared in disbelief at the man's Ingersoll watch he'd last seen in the display cabinet at Mr. Deakin's shop.
"Thank you,"
Harry repeated, as he strapped the watch on his wrist. He couldn't take his eyes off it for some time, and could only wonder how old Jack could possibly afford 6 shillings. Harry was wide awake long before the sun rose on the morning of the exams. He skipped breakfast in favour of going over some old general knowledge papers, checking capitals against countries from Germany to Brazil, dates of prime ministers from Walpole to Lloyd George, and of monarchs from King Alfred to George V. An hour later, he felt ready to face the examiner. Once again, he was seated in the front row between Barrington and Deakins. Was this the last time? He wondered. When the clock on the tower struck 10, several masters marched down the rows of desks, handing out the general knowledge paper to 40 nervous boys. Well, 39 nervous boys and Deakins. Harry read through the questions slowly. When he reached number 100, he allowed a smile to cross his face. He picked up his pen, dipped the nib in the inkwell, and began to write. 40 minutes later, he was back at question 100. He glanced at his watch. He still had another 10 minutes in which to double-check his answers. He stopped for a moment at question 34 and reconsidered his original answer. Was it Oliver Cromwell or Thomas Cromwell who was sent to the Tower of London for treason? He recalled the fate of Cardinal Wolsey and selected the man who'd taken his place as Lord Chancellor. When the clock began to strike again, Harry had reached question 92. He quickly looked over his last 8 answers before his paper was snatched away, the ink still drying on his final answer, Charles Lindbergh. During the 20-minute break, Harry, Giles, and Deakins walked slowly around the cricket field where Giles had scored a century only a week before. "A mow, a mass, a mat," said Deakins as he painstakingly took them through their conjugations without once referring to Kennedy's Latin primer. "Amamus, amatus, amant," repeated Harry as they made their way back towards the examination hall. When Harry handed in his Latin paper an hour later, he felt confident he'd scored more than the required 60%, and even Giles looked pleased with himself. As the three of them strolled across to the refectory, Harry put an arm round Deacon's shoulder and said, "Thanks, old chum." After Harry had read through the geography paper later that morning, he silently thanked his secret weapon. Old Jack had passed on so much knowledge over the years without ever making him feel that he'd been in a classroom. Harry didn't pick up a knife or fork during lunch. Giles managed half a pork pie, while Deakins didn't stop eating. History was the first paper that afternoon and didn't cause him any anxiety. Henry VIII, Elizabeth, Raleigh, Drake, Napoleon, Nelson and Wellington all marched on to the battlefield and Harry marched them back off again. The mathematics paper was far easier than he had expected, and Giles even thought he might have scored another century. During the final break, Harry returned to his study and glanced over an essay he'd written on David Copperfield, confident that he would excel in his favourite subject. He walked slowly back to the examination hall, repeating Mr. Holcomb's favourite word again and again. Concentrate. He stared down at the final paper of the day to find that this year belonged to Thomas Hardy and Lewis Carroll. He'd read The Mayor of Casterbridge and Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, but The Mad Hatter, Michael Henchard and the Cheshire Cat were not as familiar to him as Peggotty, Dr. Chillip and Barkis. His pen scratched slowly across the page, and when the clock chimed on the hour, he wasn't sure if he'd done enough. He walked out of the hall and into the afternoon sunshine, feeling a little depressed, although it was clear from the looks on the faces of his rivals that no one thought it had been an easy paper. That made him wonder if he was still in with a chance. There followed what Mr. Holcombe had often described as the worst part of any exam. Those days of endless waiting before the results were formally posted on the school notice board. A time when boys end up doing something they will later regret, almost as if they want to be rusticated rather than learn their fate. One boy was caught drinking cider behind the bicycle shed, another smoking a woodbine in the lavatory, while a third was seen leaving the local cinema after lights out. Giles was out for a duck the following Saturday, his first of the season, while Deakins returned to the library Harry went on long walks, going over every answer in his head, again and again. It didn't improve matters. On Sunday afternoon, Giles had a long net. On Monday, Deakins reluctantly handed over his responsibilities to the new library monitor, and on Tuesday, Harry read Far From the Madding Crowd and cursed out loud. On Wednesday night, Giles and Harry talked into the small hours, while Deakins slept soundly. Long before the clock on the tower struck 10 that Thursday morning, 40 boys were already roaming around the quad, hands in pockets, heads bowed, as they waited for the headmaster to make his appearance. Although every one of them knew that Dr. Oakshott wouldn't be a minute early or a minute late, by 5 to 10 most eyes were staring across the quad, waiting for the door of the headmaster's house to open. The rest were looking up at the clock on the great hall, willing the minute hand to move a little faster. As the first chimes sounded, the Reverend Samuel Oakshott opened his front door and stepped out onto the path. He was carrying a sheet of paper in one hand and 4 tin tacks in the other. Not a man who left anything to chance. When he reached the end of the path, he opened the little wicket gate and walked across the quad at his usual pace, oblivious to all around him. The boys quickly stood aside, creating a corridor so the headmaster's progress would not be impeded. He came to a halt in front of the notice board as the 10th chime rang out. He posted the exam results on the board and departed without a word. 40 boys rushed forward, forming a scrum around the notice board. No one was surprised that Deakins headed the list with 92% and had been awarded the Peliquin Scholarship to Bristol Grammar School. Giles leapt in the air, making no attempt to disguise his relief when he saw 64% by his name. They both turned to look for their friend. Harry was standing alone, far from the madding crowd.
Maisie Clifton, 1920 to 1936. Chapter 11. When Arthur and me got married, the occasion couldn't have been described as pushing the boat out. But then, neither the Tangcocks nor the Cliftons ever did have 2 brass farthings to rub together. The biggest expense turned out to be the choir, 0.5 crown, and worth every penny. I'd always wanted to be a member of Miss Monday's choir, and although she told me my voice was good enough, I wasn't considered on account of the fact I couldn't read or write. The reception, if you could call it that, was held at Arthur's parents' terraced house in Stillhouse Lane. A barrel of beer, some peanut butter sandwiches, and 12 pork pies. My brother Stan even brought his own fish and chips, and to top it all, we had to leave early to catch the last bus to Weston-super-Mare for our honeymoon. Arthur booked us into a seafront guest house on the Friday evening, and, as it rained for most of the weekend, we rarely left the bedroom. It felt strange that the second time I had sex was also in Weston-super-Mare. I was shocked when I saw Arthur naked for the first time. A deep red, roughly stitched scar stretched tight across his stomach. Damn the Germans. He never said he'd been wounded during the war. I wasn't surprised that Arthur became aroused the moment I pulled off my slip, but I must admit I'd expected him to take his boots off before we made love. We checked out at the guest house on Sunday afternoon and caught the last bus back to Bristol, as Arthur had to report to the dockyard by 6 o'clock on Monday morning. After the wedding, Arthur moved into our house, just until we could afford a place of our own, he told my father, which usually meant until one of our parents passed away. In any case, both our families had lived on Stillhouse Lane for as long as anyone could remember. Arthur was delighted when I told him I was in the family way, because he wanted at least 6 babies. My worry was whether the first would be his. but as only my mum and I knew the truth, there was no reason for Arthur to be suspicious. 8 months later, I gave birth to a boy, and thank God there was nothing to suggest that he wasn't Arthur's. We christened him Harold, which pleased my father because it meant his name would survive for another generation. From then on, I took it for granted that, like Mum and Gran, I would be stuck at home having a baby every other year. After all, Arthur came from a family of eight, and I was the fourth of five. But Harry turned out to be my only child. Arthur usually came straight home after work of an evening so he could spend some time with the baby before I put him to bed. When he didn't turn up that Friday night, I assumed he'd gone off to the pub with my brother. But when Stan staggered in just after midnight, blind drunk and flashing a wad of fibres, Arthur was nowhere to be seen. In fact, Stan gave me one of the fivers, which made me wonder if he'd robbed a bank. But when I asked him where Arthur was, he clammed up. I didn't go to bed that night, just sat on the bottom step of the stairs waiting for my husband to come home. Arthur had never stayed out all night from the day we was married. Although Stan had sobered up by the time he came down to the kitchen the following morning, he didn't say a word during breakfast. When I asked him again where Arthur was, he claimed he hadn't seen him since they'd clocked off work the previous evening. It's not difficult to tell when Stan's lying, because he won't look you in the eye. I was about to press him further when I heard a loud banging on the front door. My first thought was that it must be Arthur, so I rushed to answer it. When I opened the door, two policemen burst into the house, ran into the kitchen, grabbed Stan, handcuffed him, and told him he was being arrested for burglary. Now I knew where the wad of fivers had come from. "I didn't steal anything," protested Stan. "Mr. Barrington gave me the money." "A likely story, Tancock," said the first copper. "But it's the God's honest truth, officer," he was saying as they dragged him off to the nick. This time, I knew Stan wasn't lying. I left Harry with my mum and ran all the way to the dockyard, hoping to find that Arthur had reported for the morning shift and would be able to tell me why Stan had been arrested. I tried not to think about the possibility that Arthur might also be locked up. The man on the gate told me he hadn't seen Arthur all morning. But after he checked the rota, he looked puzzled because Arthur hadn't clocked off the night before. All he had to say was, "Don't blame me, I wasn't on the gate last night." It was only later that I wondered why he'd used the word blame. I went into the dockyard and asked some of Arthur's mates, but they all parroted the same line. "Haven't seen him since he clocked off last night." Then they quickly walked away. I was about to go off to the nick to see if Arthur had been arrested as well, when I saw an old man going past, head bowed. I chased after him, quite expecting him to tell me to bugger off or claim he didn't know what I was talking about. But when I approached, he stopped, took off his cap and said, "Good morning." I was surprised by his good manners, which gave me the confidence to ask him if he'd seen Arthur that morning.
"No," he replied. "I last saw him yesterday afternoon when he was on the late shift with your brother. Perhaps you should ask him."
"I can't," I said. "He's been arrested and taken off to the nick."
"What have they charged him with?"
asked old Jack, looking puzzled. "I don't know," I replied. Old Jack shook his head.
"I can't help you, Mrs. Clifton," he said, "but there are at least two people who know the whole story."
He nodded towards the large red brick building that Arthur always called management. I shivered when I saw a policeman coming out of the front door of the building, and when I looked back, old Jack had disappeared. I thought about going into management, or Barrington House to give it its proper name, but decided against it. After all, what would I say if I came face to face with Arthur's boss? In the end, I began to walk aimlessly back home, trying to make sense of things. I watched Hugo Barrington when he gave his evidence. The same self-confidence, the same arrogance, the same half-truths spouted convincingly to the jury, just as he'd whispered them to me in the privacy of the bedroom. When he stepped down from the witness box, I knew Stan didn't have a snowball's chance in hell of getting off. In the judge's summing up, he described my brother as a common thief who had taken advantage of his position to rob his employer. He ended by saying he had no choice but to send him down for 3 years. I had sat through every day of the trial, hoping to pick up some snippet of information that might give me a clue as to what had happened to Arthur that day. But by the time the judge finally declared, "Court adjourned," I was none the wiser, although I was in no doubt that my brother wasn't telling the whole story. It would be some time before I found out why. The only other person who attended the court every day was old Jack Tarr, but we didn't speak. In fact, I might never have seen him again if it hadn't been for Harry. It was some time before I was able to accept that Arthur would never be coming home. Stan had only been away for a few days before I discovered the true meaning of the words, "eke out." With one of the two breadwinners in the family banged up and the other God knows where, we soon found ourselves quite literally on the breadline. Luckily, there was an unwritten code that still operated in Stillhouse Lane. If someone was away on holiday, the neighbours did whatever they could to help support his family. The Reverend Watts dropped in regularly and even returned some of the coins we'd put in his collection plate over the years. Miss Munday appeared irregularly and dispensed far more than good advice, always leaving with an empty basket. But nothing could compensate me for the loss of a husband, an innocent brother locked up in jail, and a son who no longer had a father. Harry had recently taken his first step, but I was already fearful of hearing his first word. Would he even remember who used to sit at the head of the table and ask why he was no longer there? It was Grandpa who came up with a solution as to what we should say if Harry started to ask questions. We all made a pact to stick to the same story. After all, Harry was hardly likely to come across old Jack. But at that time, the Tancock family's most pressing problem was how to keep the wolf from our door, or, more important, the rent collector and the bailiff. Once I'd spent Stan's £5, pawned my mum's silver-plated tea strainer, my engagement ring, and finally my wedding ring, I feared it couldn't be long before we were evicted. But that was delayed for a few weeks by another knock on the door. This time it wasn't the police, but a man called Mr. Sparks, who told me he was Arthur's trade union representative and that he'd come to see if I'd had any compensation from the company. Once I'd settled Mr. Sparks down in the kitchen and poured him a cup of tea, I told him, "Not a brass farthing. They say he left without giving notice, so they aren't responsible for his actions. And I still don't know what really happened that day."
"Neither do I," said Mr. Sparks. "They've all clammed up. Not just the management, but the workers as well. I can't get a word out of them. More than my life's worth, one of them told me. But your husband's subs were fully paid up," he added, "so you're entitled to union compensation."
I just stood there, with no idea what he was going on about. Mr. Sparks took a document out of his briefcase, placed it on the kitchen table, and turned to the back page.
"Sign here,"
he said, placing a forefinger on the dotted line. After I had put an X where he was pointing, he took an envelope out of his pocket.
"I'm sorry it's so little," he said as he handed it to me.
I didn't open the envelope until he had finished his cup of tea and left. £7.09.6 turned out to be the value they'd put on Arthur's life. I sat alone at the kitchen table, and I think that was the moment I knew I'd never see my husband again. That afternoon, I went back to the pawn shop and redeemed my wedding ring from Mr. Cohen. It was the least I could do in memory of Arthur. The following morning, I cleared the rent arrears, as well as the slate at the butcher, the baker, and, yes, the candlestick maker. There was just enough left over to buy some second-hand clothes from the church jumble sale, mostly for Harry. But it was less than a month before the chalk was once again scratching across the slate at the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker, and it wasn't long after that that I had to return to the pawn shop and hand my wedding ring back to Mr. Cohen. When the rent collector came knocking on the door of number 27 and never received a reply, I suppose none of the family should have been surprised that the next caller would be the bailiff. That was when I decided the time had come for me to look for a job.
Chapter 12. Maisie's attempts to find a job didn't turn out to be easy, not least because the government had recently issued a directive to all employers advising them to take on men who had served in the armed forces before considering any other candidates. This was in keeping with Lloyd George's promise that Britain's soldiers would return home to a land fit for heroes. Although women over 30 had been given the vote at the last election after their sterling service in munitions factories during the war, they were pushed to the back of the queue when it came to peacetime jobs. Maisie decided that her best chance of finding employment was to apply for jobs men wouldn't consider, either because they felt they were too demeaning or the pay was derisory. With that in mind, Maisie stood in line outside W.D. and H.O. Wills, the city's largest employer. When she reached the front of the queue, she asked the supervisor, "Is it true you're looking for packers in the cigarette factory?"
"Yes, but you're too young, love," he told her.
"I'm 22.
"You're too young," he repeated. "Come back in 2 or 3 years' time." Maisie was back at Stillhouse Lane in time to share a bowl of chicken broth and a slice of last week's bread with Harry and her mum. The next day she joined an even longer queue outside Harvey's, the wine merchant's. When she reached the front, 3 hours later, she was told by a man wearing a starched white collar and a thin black tie that they were only taking on applicants with experience.
"So how do I get experience?" Maisie asked, trying not to sound desperate.
"By joining our apprentice scheme."
"Then I'll join," she told the starched collar.
"How old are you?"
22.
"You're too old."
Maisie repeated every word of the 60-second interview to her mother over a thinner bowl of broth from the same pot, along with a crust of bread from the same loaf.
"You could always try the docks," her mother suggested.
"What do you have in mind, Mum? Should I sign up to be a stevedore?"
Maisie's mum didn't laugh, but then Maisie couldn't remember the last time she had.
"They've always got work for cleaners," she said, "and God knows that lot owe you."
Maisie was up and dressed long before the sun had risen the following morning, and, as there wasn't enough breakfast to go round, she set out hungry on the long walk to the docks. When she arrived, Maisie told the man on the gate she was looking for a cleaning job.
"Report to Mrs. Nettles," he said,
nodding in the direction of the large red brick building she'd so nearly entered once before.
"She's in charge of iron and firing cleaners." He clearly didn't remember her from her previous visit.
Maisie walked uneasily towards the building, but came to a halt a few paces before she reached the front door. She stood and watched as a succession of smartly dressed men, wearing hats and coats and carrying umbrellas, made their way through the double doors. Maisie remained rooted to the spot, shivering in the cold morning air, as she tried to find enough courage to follow them inside. She was just about to turn away when she spotted an older woman in overalls entering another door at the side of the building. Maisie chased after her.
"What do you want?"
asked the woman suspiciously, once Maisie had caught up with her.
"I'm looking for a job."
"Good," she said. "We could do with some young'uns. Report to Mrs. Nettles," she added, pointing towards a narrow door that might have been mistaken for a broom cupboard. Maisie walked boldly up to it and knocked.
"Come on in," said a tired voice.
Maisie opened the door to find a woman of about her mother's age sitting on the only chair, surrounded by buckets, mops, and several large bars of soap.
"I was told to report to you if I was looking for a job."
"You was told right. That's if you're willing to work all the hours God gives for damn all pay."
"What are the hours, and what's the pay?" asked Maisie.
"You start at 3 a.m, and you have to be off the premises by 7 before their nibs turns up, when they expect to find their offices spick and span. Or you can start at 7 p.m. and work through till midnight, whichever suits you. Pay's the same whatever you decide, 6 an hour.
"I'll do both shifts," said Maisie.
"Good," the woman said, selecting a bucket and mop. "I'll see you back here at 7 this evening, when I'll show you the ropes. My name's Vera Nettles. What's yours?"
"Maisie Clifton."
Mrs. Nettles dropped the bucket on the floor and propped the mop back up against the wall. She walked across to the door and opened it.
"There's no work for you here, Mrs. Clifton," she said.
Over the next month, Maisie tried to get a job in a shoe shop, but the manager didn't feel he could employ someone with holes in her shoes. A milliner's, where the interview was terminated the moment they discovered she couldn't add up, and a flower shop, which wouldn't consider taking on anyone who didn't have their own garden. Grandpa's allotment didn't count. In desperation, she applied for a job as a barmaid in a local pub, but the landlord said,
"Sorry, love, but your tits aren't big enough."
The following Sunday at Holy Nativity, Maisie knelt and asked God to give her a helping hand. That hand turned out to be Miss Monday's, who told Maisie she had a friend who owned a tea shop on Broad Street and was looking for a waitress.
"But I don't have any experience,"